By all independent accounts, the Russia-Ukraine war is probably in its death knell. It is probably getting close to the end game, where Ukraine is simply running out of people, the West is running out of ammunition, and Russia continues to increase in all categories. So I think we're probably getting close, and probably sometime in the early 2026, it's entirely possible, though not guaranteed, that this war could come to an end. Then what happens next? And then this episode, we're going to look at some of the things that are happening at the current time, but also what may be next and what danger does the Russian side pose both to the United States and to the West at large? And are we heading to some kind of conflict that we may not be able to handle? Those are some really important questions to answer. We like to always look beyond just what's in front of our nose here, because oftentimes that can be the most important thing, to try to help us make sense out of what's coming and to put things in context. We have the amazing John Mearsheimer, international relations theorist, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and big time friend of the show. John, welcome back as always.
Glad to be here, and thank you for your kind words, Danny.
Well, listen, you know, this war, I don't want to be premature and say that the war is over, but given the continuing growth of evidence that shows that things are trending in the Russian side, and I could go on a whole detail analysis of the front line from Zaporizhia all the way up to the Kharkiv area, Pokrovsk, of course, that's in the news. Kharkiv Oblast is in the news. Kupiansk is in the news. All of these are moving in the Russia's direction. We could talk a lot about that too. But I want to actually pull back just a wee bit to the operational level, first of all, because it was a video released just about an hour and a half ago, actually, from our time here. And Lavrov was asked a question about the terms about the ending of the war. One of the things he said was, we haven't changed. He specifically brought up, which something you and I cite many times, is the June 14th, 2024 terms set by Putin, which were demilitarization, denazification, the no NATO, and then some territorial issues and some other issues related to the people and their rights within whatever's left of Ukraine. So he said those haven't changed. That's still the case here. But one of the things that one of the reporters asked him was about this denazification thing. What does that even look like, and why is that an issue? Here's what he said.
Zelensky regularly poses on television screens, awarding fighters of Azov and other Nazi battalions with patches of fascist Germany on their sleeves. How else should one relate to this person? That is why Nazism is an undeniable, I mean, the destruction of Nazism in Ukraine, denazification is an indispensable condition for a settlement if we want it to be long term. And we want that, and we'll achieve it.
So that kind of, I guess, juxtaposes well, or not juxtaposes, but meshes well with what President Putin said in Beijing just a month or so ago, when he said, we will accomplish it, our objectives, all of them, diplomatically or on the battlefield. And that seems to be what he's talking about there. But that's one of the big ones, the denazification, because what they've said, and in the context of those comments there, it was root causes, which he says many, many times, of course, all of them do. But that's one of the big ones, the denazification. And what do you think, if you're a Westerner, if you're a Kievian, what do you hear when you hear him say denazification in terms of the Zelensky regime sitting in Kiev today?
Well, it definitely means he wants to get rid of the Zelensky regime. And more generally, he wants to change the basic nature of the regime. I think this goal is unachievable. I think the main three goals that the Russians seek and may be able to achieve are, number one, make sure that Ukraine doesn't join NATO. Number two, possibly get Ukraine and the West to accept annexation of some territory. And number three, agree to reduce the offensive potency of the Ukrainian military. Those three threats, they may be able to get the Ukrainians and the West to agree to. But the denazification argument, which really amounts to regime change, I think is impossible to get without conquering all of Ukraine. Just think about denazification in World War II. you had to put an end to the Third Reich. And the only way you could put an end to the Third Reich was to go into Berlin and do away with Hitler and his lieutenants. If you had stopped on the Polish-German border, then you wouldn't have ended up with denazification, at least in the short term. You had to go in and physically destroy the regime, and then you were in a position where you could do denazification. That's what happens in World War II. And that's not going to happen here. The Russians are not going to end up conquering all of Ukraine. There's going to be a dysfunctional rump state that's left over. And I think in all likelihood, the people who the Russians identify as Nazis will have a great deal of power. Because I think when you fight a protracted war like the Ukrainians have been fighting, the more extreme elements in your society grow more powerful over time, because nationalism is mobilized to fight the war, and nationalism feeds in to extremist ideologies like fascism. So I just don't see how the Russians can achieve that goal. I understand full well that that's what they want to do, but I'd be shocked if they were able to achieve it.
And one wonders if maybe that isn't what they intend. And I'm going to show you some potential evidence in it, which could facilitate that. And one of the things that is what Lavrov himself said about 3 weeks ago when he was addressing one of the issues that at the time was kind of up in the news cycle there, were the Western side had been for a long time saying we want an unconditional ceasefire, just stop right where we are. And at that time, Trump was actually pushing that, just stop on the current line of contact and let's just figure this out and get it over with. And Lavrov talked about why that's not a good idea.
The Europeans are trying to dominate the agenda with the rhetoric about ceasefire. They zigzagging depending on what is going on the front line. Root causes. That's what must be key to understanding how to help end this situation efficiently.
And if root causes, and one of which was the Nazification, as the Russian side view it, might they be saying, hey, we're going to just keep going militarily until we denazify you by force?
They can say that till they're blue in the face. The question is, can they do it? I don't think they can do it without conquering all of Ukraine. And I think they would be foolish in the extreme to try and conquer all of Ukraine and do regime change. This is social engineering at the end of a rifle barrel. And as you know well, and I know well, this usually doesn't end up well. But look, Nazification was not the root cause of this conflict. It was bringing Ukraine into NATO. That was the root cause. We've been saying this ad nauseum for years now. And if the Russians can create a situation where the West and Ukraine agree that Ukraine will be neutral, it will not be in NATO, and there will not be meaningful security guarantees from the West, then I think you can go a long way towards achieving a frozen conflict. I just don't think the denazification issue is all that important for getting a settlement. Again, the key issue is NATO expansion. And also now you have to throw in the lost territories.
Right. And when part of the comments from the Lavrov's comments from today were again about those very issues, and specifically about the Russian speakers inside of whatever is left over on the Ukraine side, or, you know, if there's a settlement that's come in and they're still trying to push for that. One wonders, though, if Russia isn't in the process of trying to at least create uncertainty in the minds of the West and the United States in particular, that they can and maybe want to conquer all of Ukraine. But then the bigger issue from the Western side, at least rhetorically, is, well, they're coming after us. And for many times, Russians say, oh, well, that's ridiculous, we're not going to do that. But yet, when you look at some of the other actions, they seem to be kind of quietly trying to convey, maybe, like maybe we have some capabilities here and we are thinking beyond that, perhaps to create uncertainty. I'm not sure what, I'm just guessing at what their intent may be, but there are a number of things I'd like to run through with you here that make it look like that they're thinking beyond the end of this, and what might that be? One of which is actually, ironically, in the schoolyard. because there was a piece out in the Wall Street Journal today that Putin is turning eighth grade classrooms into army training grounds. And a couple of interesting things he says here is that one, yeah, Gary's going to roll down to that. That right here is that wars are won not by generals, but by school teachers, Vladimir Putin said in the 2023, and saying that, they need to have these folks, these kids learn martial activities even as kids. Forget about whether or not they join later on. I guess they have some requirement to. But as you were telling us before we went on air here, this by itself is not new in this part of the world.
Well, I think there's no question that when you fight a war, you want an army that is filled with intelligent soldiers. I think there's a powerful tendency among people who don't know much about militaries to think that what you want are a bunch of wild and crazy boys or young men who will charge machine guns when they're directed to do so. And that's what wins wars. And that's, of course, not true. You want an army that's peopled from top to bottom with very smart people, because when you're out on the battlefield, you're in a world that's incredibly complicated. There's all sorts of uncertainty. Things are happening rapidly. And you want smart soldiers who can make quick decisions. And again, you want that at the very bottom as well as at the very top. So you want an educated military. And what you want are for people in your population to be well-educated in schools so that when they're drafted or mobilized into the army, what you're getting are people, you know, who can think critically, who can think on their feet. And at the end of the 19th century, after the Germans defeated the French, actually it was the Prussians who defeated the French in the Franco-Prussian War, in 1870, and then, of course, Prussia became Germany. Much was made of the fact that the Germans had an army that was filled with people who were well-educated. And that's when the idea that, you know, wars were won in the schoolroom really came to the fore. And I think what you're seeing here is somewhat different in the sense that what Putin is trying to do is not so much worry about getting people educated. What he's interested in doing is getting people committed to the long war. Now, you're wondering what I'm saying here. This gets back to my point, Danny, that the Russians are not going to win a decisive victory. I don't believe they're going to get regime change in Kyiv. And you're going to get a frozen conflict. And that frozen conflict is going to be part and parcel of a long, cold peace. And what that means is that the West, and here we're talking mainly about the Europeans and the Ukrainians are going to be doing everything they can to cause the Russians trouble in the areas of Ukraine that they annex. And the Russians are going to be doing everything they can to cause the Ukrainians in that rump Ukrainian state trouble, cause the Europeans trouble, and cause trouble across the Atlantic Ocean between the United States on one side and the Europeans on the other. What you have to understand here is we're going to have poisonous relations between Russia and the West for as far as the eye can see. In other words, there's not going to be any meaningful settlement to this war because the goals on the two sides are just irreconcilable. So the Russians, as you like to say, and I like to say, are going to win on the battlefield. But it's going to be an ugly victory in the sense that it's not a decisive victory. This war is going to end up in a frozen conflict, and the politics, again, are going to be poisonous. And the Russians are preparing themselves for that because who knows? The conflict may flare up again. The frozen conflict may turn into a hot conflict. As you well know, the Ukrainians are not going to be satisfied with losing all this territory, and they're going to go to great lengths to see if they can get it back. They're going to foment trouble in the Russian-occupied areas or the Russian-annexed areas of Ukraine. And the Russians may lash back. You may get a conflict there. You may get a conflict in the Arctic, in the Baltic. You may get a conflict in Belarus, Moldova. or in the Black Sea, or in Kaliningrad. There are just all sorts of potential flashpoints here, which are set in the context of a poisonous political environment. So in that situation, of course, the Russians are preparing for the long term. They want an educated population for the reasons I described before. But not only do they want an educated population, they want a population that's thinking in military or strategic terms from, let's say, the eighth grade on. This is what you see happening here. And all of this tells you, Danny, just what a catastrophic mistake we made trying to bring Ukraine into NATO and precipitating this war, which is going to have hugely negative consequences for as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, and you can see that section that Gary's highlighting right there, and even a little bit above it, funding for patriotic education was increased to $42 million. And then they specifically talk about how Kalashnikovs, grenades, and drone kits, so they are training them up for modern warfare and things that are escalating beyond that. One wonders, and I can see the theory that you're drawing there, that one way or the other, they seem to be preparing for something long, whether that's a continual conflict in the Ukraine or some of these expanded areas beyond there. And it appears to me, or it occurs to me anyway, that Russia maybe they're thinking along the same lines that you are, and the potential flashes beyond that, which they don't want to fight. But Putin seems to be laying a foundation here that says, don't test me because we can't. Now, there was also not long ago, you may recall, President Trump famously sent a Truth Social out where he says Russia's just a paper tiger and probably Ukraine can go and do a lot of stuff, which was kind of weird at face value. But Putin said about that comment.
And he is teasing, saying that it is a paper tiger. A paper tiger? I already said that Russia all these years has been fighting not with the armed forces of Ukraine, not with Ukraine, but practically with all the NATO countries. And everywhere the Russian troops are confidently, I want to emphasize this, holding the strategic initiative. But if we are fighting against the whole NATO bloc and are still moving, advancing, feeling confident, and this is a paper tiger, then what is NATO itself? What does it then represent?
Now, I know one of the common themes that I hear in the West, especially among some of the leader in the so-called expert level, is that Russia is a paper tiger because, you know, they've had this terrible time, almost 4 years of war against this little bitty tiny Ukraine and this big behemoth of the Russia, and they can't even get more than 20% so far. So, yeah, they're a paper tiger. Then the contrary side to that is that the Russians are saying, oh, yeah, it ain't just us against this little tiny Ukraine. It's us against all of the military capacity anyway, minus the soldiers, of NATO, and using the Ukraine's troops as the hammer, so to speak, against fighting. Which side of that is right?
Well, the Russians are not a paper tiger. Anybody who makes that argument is remarkably foolish. If you took the Russian army and you put it up against the British army, this would be an unfair fight. You could take any army in Europe and put it up against the Russian army and it would lose. The American army is a different matter. But I think if you took the American military, you put it in Ukraine, it went up against the Russians, it would not be a quick and decisive victory for the Americans, not by any means. The Russians have a formidable military force. As you and I have talked about before, the Russian army that exists today is a much more formidable army than the one that existed in February 2022 when it invaded Ukraine. So this is no paper tiger. What's going on here is that the Russians understand that the West is a mortal threat, and the West is a mortal threat. You want to remember that the West's goal in this war from the beginning has been to defeat Russia and Ukraine, wreck the Russian economy with sanctions, and bring the Russians to their knees. We've been unable to do that, but that doesn't mean we don't want to do it. Of course we want to do it. And if the opportunity to do it popped up tomorrow, we would leap at it in a second. We would love to finish Russia off as a great power. And Putin, the last time I checked, has a triple-digit IQ. And that means he's figured this out. He understands what he's dealing with. And as far as Trump is concerned, can he trust Trump as far as he can throw him with his hands tied behind his back? That's Putin's hands tied behind his back? The answer is no. He cannot trust Trump at all. And he certainly can't trust the European leaders. And in good realist fashion, he is assuming worst case. Who can blame him at this point in time?
And I wanted to actually go there, Nick, because that was he's in his comments there just a second ago at the Valdai conference. He was basically talking about the tactical or operational along the front lines, et cetera. Well, he subsequently talked about things just recently at the strategic level that they're also making advancements that we should pay attention to.
All our plans for creating advanced weapon systems, developing the defense industry, and equipping the Russian Army and Navy with modern equipment and weapons are being fulfilled. With an eye on the development and deployment of the latest Avangard strategic missile system, we have developed, deployed, and begun serial production of the Oreshnik medium-range missile system. We've equipped our intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine-launched missiles with modern anti-ballistic missile defense systems. This year, we'll be deploying heavy intercontinental ballistic missile systems, the SARMAT, into combat deployment, and next year, into combat duty. And finally, the reason we've gathered here today. Russia finally has the Vestnik unlimited range cruise missile and the Poseidon nuclear-powered unmanned underwater vehicle. All our plans are being fulfilled.
So he's talking about not just the Burevestnik, not just the Poseidon, the Oreshnik, and other hypersonics that they have, which have dual use capabilities, et cetera. He seems to be saying, hey, we're not just sitting still. We're expanding our strategic capabilities. Don't test us. How do you read it?
I think there's just no question about that. I think he worries, as he should, that the Americans may think that they can develop some sort of meaningful nuclear decapitation strategy. And he's sending a very clear signal that that's not going to happen. When it comes to looking at the strategic nuclear balance, please be aware, Washington and European leaders, that we are developing an ever more sophisticated nuclear retaliatory force. And we have the capability to destroy the United States if you think you can destroy Russia. It's just not going to happen. This is independent of what's happening on the battlefield, because that's different. It's the different realm. But what Putin was really talking about there was more related to the strategic nuclear balance. And he's making it clear that at that level or in that realm, the West is not going to have an advantage. The Russians will negate any advantage that we think we can gain. And of course, on the battlefield, they're clearly not a paper tiger.
And now, all in the strategic realm, as you put it, we've also recently had, in fact, at the time when Putin was talking about that they tested what they claim is this Burevestnik missile, which is an unlimited range cruise missile that could be nuclear capability, and then the Poseidon subsurface in the water, et cetera. In response to that, Trump said, oh, yeah, well, if you're going to test nuclear weapons, we're going to test nuclear weapons. Now, initially, people said, OK, you mean nuclear platforms, right? Like the Minuteman III or something like that. Trump wouldn't clarify what he meant. He said nuclear test. And of course, many people mean a nuclear explosion test, whether underground or not. Because Trump wouldn't clarify that, then the Russians went back and said, oh, by the way, Belousov, the Minister of Defense, on a televised briefing said that, you know what, we should bring our nuclear weapon testing facility back up online. And then Putin subsequently said, yeah, and we're going to maintain the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We won't test, but if you do, we're going to test and we're going to make the capability for it. Two questions for you. First of all, we'll start with this one. Do you think the United States would actually conduct a nuclear weapons test, a detonation of some sort?
There's no need to. There's no need to. I mean, this is one of these instances where Trump was just talking off the cuff, and Trump actually misunderstood what was happening on the other side. The Russians weren't testing nuclear warheads. They were testing nuclear propulsion systems. It's a fundamentally different matter. But Trump thought that the Russians were testing nuclear weapons. So he said, if they're testing nuclear weapons, we're going to test nuclear weapons. But again, they weren't testing nuclear weapons. And even if they were, the question is whether we need to test our nuclear weapons to check out their reliability. And the fact is that we don't. So even if the Russians want to test nuclear weapons, there's no need for us to duplicate what they're doing, any more than I think there's a need for them to duplicate what we're doing. We can check out the reliability of our nuclear arsenal, our nuclear warheads, and they, the Russians, can check out the reliability of their nuclear warheads without underground tests. So this is really kind of a foolish issue that results from Trump not knowing what he was talking about.
And well, who's to argue it wasn't foolish, but it was deepened a little bit more on November the 4th when there was a confirmation hearing in the Senate, which ironically was attended by almost no one. When you look at the camera ending, there's almost no one in the room except for a few of the senators and Robert Kudlak, who was his position, I think, if I remember correctly, is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for nuclear weapons testing, something to that effect. And one of the questions was, are we even talking about nuclear bomb testing, nuclear warhead testing? And he expressly said, we don't need to. He said exactly what you said. We don't need to do that. So there's no issue about the reliability and capability. It's not necessary. And then he said, but if there was a geopolitical need to do so, I guess that would be a different conversation. Well, Lavrov right up on that. And he said, yeah, if you do that, because we know you don't need to, then that only leads us to believe that you have other motives inside. And that just kind of deepened the paranoia, if you will, or the concern anyway, on the Russian side. Given that continual verbal, I don't even know what to call it, gaffes, or just continuing to go down a line of something that doesn't matter, what does that tell you?
Look, I know very well from the Cold War that we and the Soviets had reached a point by the mid-1960s where we each had an assured destruction capability. We lived in a world of mutual assured destruction, MAD. Now, what exactly does that mean? That means that no matter who struck first, the other side could retaliate and destroy the other side's, the first striker's side. They could destroy its society, its economic infrastructure, its population. We still live in a mad world. The Russians have more than enough nuclear weapons, even after they're struck first, to turn the United States into a smoking, radiating ruin. And if they struck first at us, we have more than enough nuclear weapons to turn them into a smoking, irradiating ruin. We live in a mad world. So there's all this talk these days about the Russians developing this new missile or us doing this or that. And the idea is that it's going to give us an advantage. That's not going to happen. We live in a mad world. There's no way either side can develop the capability to achieve a splendid first strike. That's where you take out the other side's assured destruction capability. Nevertheless, both sides are going to continue to talk about how dangerous it is when the other side develops a new weapon or the other side tests its nuclear arsenal. But in the final analysis, it just doesn't matter because, again, we live in a mad world. If you're going to use nuclear weapons, the only way you can use them is in a limited way and then hope that you don't get escalation. But the idea that you can attack the other side and achieve a splendid first strike is not realizable. There are just too many warheads. If you have 1,000 warheads and you get 98% of the other side's warheads, which is extremely unlikely. We used to run these exercises during the Cold War. If you get 98% of the other side's 1,000 warheads, strategic nuclear warheads, there's still going to be plenty of warheads left to turn your society into a smoking, radiating ruin. And then when you throw in things like nuclear winter, and so forth and so on. It's just hard to see how anybody can win a nuclear war. Nevertheless, we're going to continue to talk about that. We're going to continue to talk about the advantages of underground tests of nuclear warheads as if this mattered. But I'm happy to say it doesn't matter because, again, we live in a mad world.
Yeah, that's uppercase MAD and lowercase MAD. They both are equally applicable. Getting back to the less mad world, but still angry, maybe we could put it that way. The Russians, one of the other things they've been talking about here is that this this obsession, I think, is the only kind way you can put it, that the West has with using sanctions, which you mentioned a minute ago, to try to bring Russia to their knees. And Putin also talked recently about how that's a fool's errand.
Now, regarding the new sanctions, first of all, there is nothing new here. Yes, of course, they are serious for us. That is clear. And they will have certain consequences. But they will not significantly affect our economic well-being.
President Putin basically said today that Russia is immune from U.S. sanctions. He said that it would not impact the Russian economy in any serious way. Is he
good.
Wrong?
I'm glad he feels that way. That's good. I'll let you know about it in 6 months from now. Okay, let's see. Let's see how it all works out.
Yeah, about that 6 months. I'm not sure that that's an anniversary he's going to want to go back to. What do you say?
I think Trump understands that the sanctions are not going to work. I think he's just going through the motions here. There's no evidence that the administration is working overtime to make the sanctions work. Almost everybody agrees that if this new set of sanctions that the administration put forth are going to work at all, you have to really work overtime to make them work. And we're not doing that. And even if we did, it's not going to matter very much. It's not going to affect what happens on the battlefield. It's not going to affect what's happening in terms of trade flows between China and Russia or between India and Russia. So they can talk about sanctions forever and ever, but it's just not going to do much. And again, I think Trump fully understands this. We have no cards to play, Danny. You and I have talked about this many times. Where's the Tomahawk missile these days? You hear anybody talking about the Tomahawk these days? The magic weapon that was going to turn everything around, rescue the situation? No, nobody's talking about it because basically everybody knows that the Tomahawk was not the magic weapon that was going to win the war for the Ukrainians, no matter how many we gave them. It might have made Russia's task a bit more difficult, but not very much at all. And the same thing is true with sanctions. If there was any magic formula for winning this war, Joe Biden, who was deeply committed to it, would have figured it out. A year ago today, Joe Biden was still in power. He couldn't find the magic formula. How is it that Donald Trump's going to be able to find the magic formula?
Well, the reason I use the term obsessed is because whatever Trump may know, and that was, I think, on the 20-something, 26th of October, somewhere around there, about how they laughed and, we'll see him in 6 months. That was last month. Okay, this is 2 days ago where there was a Zoom call between Volodymyr Zelensky and a number of U.S. senators, and watch how gleefully they're looking to go from the 19th sanction package that haven't worked. They're looking, by the way, in Europe to do the 20th. They're getting ready for that right now. And then apparently, on top of what the U.S. did back in October, these senators are looking to do another one after that.
What I'd like to know on the military front is, besides the Tomahawks, where can we be most helpful? Because I know continued military aid is very important, whether it's the Patriot missile interceptors or other weapon systems that would be helpful to you.
I wanted to first thank you for your leadership. Thank the Ukrainian people for their courage. I don't have a question, but I wanted to let you know, I know the ambassador is following this very closely. In the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Risch, who couldn't join us today, is the chair. I'm the ranking member. But we have put forward the first three bills out of the committee to address, to go after Russia because of their actions.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And Gene, the same. Mr. President, you've got just amazing group of champions of Ukraine here on the Zoom. It's good to see you again.
The rest of the year and beginning of 26, we're going to go all in, giving you military capability to hurt the Putin war machine even more. And we're going to try to isolate Putin even stronger than we have today. If we can pass this bill making Russia a state sponsor of terrorism under U.S. law, that makes his economy radioactive.
Right.
Amen.
Amen, he says there. And you talked about Mad World or an irradiated smoking ruin. I mean, you have You have Lindsey Graham there trying to talk about an economy that's irradiated. Even though 20 rounds of these things haven't worked so far, they somehow think it's going to work again. And you said right before we went on here, you know, mocking basically, who thinks about the tomahawk anymore? And you see, the U.S. senator does right there. Well, other than that, how can these things work? And then, to me, this is one of the, of all the things that I've shown you today, this is one of the most alarming to me, because these are key senators from both parties that are still talking at nearing the 4-year mark of this war, when everything has failed utterly to change the dynamic on the battlefield that you keep mentioning, and they still are talking like the next one will make a difference. How do you react to that?
These people are delusional. I mean, it's not worth having a serious conversation about this. I mean, what can you say? I have a more important issue to talk about. The fact is that Ukraine needs about $100 billion a year to sustain itself economically, about $100 billion a year. And the Europeans are trying to find $200 billion so that they can fund Ukraine for the next 2 years. And the problem that the Europeans face is the Americans have basically opted out of funding Ukraine. And President Trump has told the Europeans they have to do it, which is why they have to find $200 billion. Well, these are all countries that are in significant economic trouble. So the question is, where are they going to get $200 billion? And what they're thinking of doing is stealing it from those frozen Russian assets in Belgium. But the problem is they can't get the Belgians or a handful of other countries, the Italians and the French, and even the European Central Bank, to go along with this idea, because they think it may boomerang and do enormous damage to each of them. So it looks like there's no way they're going to be able to steal this Russian, these Russian frozen assets and come up with $200 billion. So the question you want to ask yourself is, put aside this nonsense about sanctions, what are the Ukrainians going to do if they don't get the full $200 billion? So when you and I talk about the situation on the battlefield, just think about what you were saying about how things are going on the battlefield. Just think about the bombing campaign that's now taking place against infrastructure in Ukraine, which we haven't talked about. Think about the fact that Trump is basically pulling out and that the Europeans can't come up with $200 billion. When you take all of those factors together, and you contrast them with what these senators were saying, you just say to yourself, is this the real world? Am I hearing these people correctly? I mean, we've reached the point in the West where it's just hard to take most of our policymakers seriously.
You know, there was a, I think it was yesterday, there was a press conference with Marco Rubio. He was talking about a whole range of different issues, one of which was on the Russia-Ukraine war. In his comments, he made kind of an offhanded comment while he was talking about something else, which really got my radar antenna firing up, because I'm like, wait, he just said out loud what we all know, and it seems to have been missed by most people. He was talking about, let's keep giving Ukraine all this stuff, and the bombing campaign that you mentioned here about how devastating it's going to be, and how, well, we need to get them some air defense interceptors, whatever, to try to protect their infrastructure. And then he makes an interesting admission on the backside. See if you catch it.
We've had those conversations with the Ukrainians about what they need, and I know that's ongoing. And, you know, clearly helping them survive the winter is important just from on a humanitarian ground. The challenge is that Ukraine's energy grid has been diminished each year. So each year they start at a lower baseline than the year before. Now, I think in Kyiv, for example, upwards of 50 to 60% of the day is spent without electrical power. And they've done a tremendous job of sort of rerouting their grid and trying to work around it. But that also means there are hours of the day where you can't, there's no water, there's no electricity. You have to schedule business and life activities around that. And that's clearly part of Russia's strategy, is to try to collapse morale within Ukraine and the will to fight. So, you know, that's why we've been in discussions with them about defensive weapons to be able to protect their grid. And I know we've been in ongoing technical conversations about the specific equipment they need. But ultimately, if that equipment is ultimately destroyed a week later after it's installed, that remains a problem. And that's been the history of the last.
It remains a problem. If a week later, what we give you is destroyed, then make that make sense to me.
You know, that was sort of the new Marco Rubio. He really sounded smart and reasonable. He was describing the problem, and he was also explaining why it can't be fixed. And of course, what you want to then do is take what Rubio said and put it together with what's happening on the battlefield and what's happening with regard to that $200 billion that they need. And the fact that Tomahawks and sanctions are not a war-winning set of weapons, and figure out how that all adds up. What does that all add up to? And as you and I have been saying ad nauseum for God knows how long, the Ukrainians are doomed. And we would have put an end to this war as quickly as possible so that Ukraine loses as little territory as possible, number one, and so that more Ukrainians do not die. Our viewpoint, Danny Davis's and John Mearsheimer's viewpoint, is occupying the moral high ground, right? All these people who think that they are pursuing the morally correct strategy by encouraging the Ukrainians to continue this fight are wrong. The smart thing to do from a moral point of view and a strategic point of view, I want to emphasize that, from a moral point of view and a strategic point of view, is to listen to you and to listen to me and to end this war. Nobody, as Marco Rubio made very clear, can come up with a way to turn this one around.
And in fact, we're not even at the zenith yet. On top of everything that you just said, and all those categories, which I won't repeat at all, but we'll add to it, Russia is in the process now of accelerating its production of missiles, strategic drones, and rockets to the tune of tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of armored vehicles, tens of thousands of additional armored vehicles, and repairing whatever. They're building up their stockpiles, millions of tactical drones, multiple millions of artillery shells. In addition to what they use on the battlefield, they're still having these big stockpiles. So for the, way distant future, they're never going to run short of any of those things, which are causing all the damage that Rubio was talking about in there. Meanwhile, on our side, we're still only producing about 600 interceptors a year. We're about one third of the artillery production. The EU continues to ramp up, but they won't even have their military if everything works in their economies to allow them to get up to 3.5% of actual military production by 2030, they'll still be behind what the Russians are because they're not slowing down. We showed some satellite imagery where they have massive, massive on the Russian side factories being built right now for military industrial. So they still haven't slowed down the increase. Given all that, I'm going to ask you a question you've really just answered. Where is the morality and the rational and the strategic willingness to go down a path that literally cannot succeed, yet we're doing it with those senators just showed you just 2 days ago, gleefully talking about leadership and all this stuff? How does all that fit together?
Well, as I said to you, it's delusional. By the way, we left out another key element in the story, which makes it even look bleaker for the Ukrainians. And it goes like this. Russia basically has one concern at this point in time, and that's the war in Ukraine. The United States has two other concerns besides the war in Ukraine. One is the Middle East, and two is East Asia. And East Asia really matters. We have this whole concept in our strategy called the pivot to Asia. The reason we have a pivot to Asia is because we consider China to be the principal threat to the United States. China is a peer competitor. Russia is not. So there's powerful pressure on us to build up our military forces in East Asia. And furthermore, there's powerful pressure on us, mainly of a domestic political sort associated with the Israel lobby, to support Israel and its many wars in the Middle East. So we're pulled in three different directions. Putin is not pulled in three different directions. Putin can concentrate on the war in Ukraine. He can focus laser-like on that. And as I said before, if you look at what President Trump is doing, he's basically trying to wash his hands of Ukraine. He's shifting the burden for handling the Ukraine portfolio, so to speak, over to the Europeans. And the Europeans are in no position to handle Ukraine without American help, to handle Ukraine by themselves. So if you look at the grand strategic picture and the situation that the United States faces versus the situation that Russia faces, this is just another example why the Russians are going to prevail. Although I want to qualify that by saying they're not going to win a decisive victory. And as I said before, I don't think they're going to get regime change. I think you're going to end up with an ugly victory, or to put it in slightly different terms, a frozen conflict in an environment that is poisonous to the core and where the potential for big trouble moving forward is very great. And again, this gets back to that whole story that you showed where the Russians are trying to get their kids in grade school militarized. They want them thinking strategically. They want them to understand that Russia lives in a threat environment. That's because the Russians understand that this conflict with the West is going to go on for a long time. And Danny, if I can make one final point on this, you want to remember that now that Finland is in NATO, the Russians have to worry about their border with Finland, and they are doing things to reinforce that border because that is a border with an important NATO state. So when you think about what's going on here, the potential for more and more trouble down the road is endless.
It certainly is. And when you say that your Russians will win an ugly victory, but not a complete destruction of the state of Ukraine, I think we've talked in the past that you say basically up to the Dnieper River to include Odessa, maybe in the south, and Kharkiv in the north. I mean, what do you consider the limit of advance?
I take about 40% if I were in Putin's shoes. Right. I mean, again, it's worth repeating this, even though you and I have talked about it many times, because the West is unwilling to accommodate the Russians in any way. And the West is still interested in wrecking Russia as a great power. The Russians, therefore, have a vested interest in taking as much territory as possible and making the remaining Ukrainian state, the Ukrainian rump state that's left over, as weak as possible. So number one, it's not much of a threat to Russia, but number two, it's not in a position where it can join NATO and the EU. So that incentivizes the Russians, I think, to take about 40% of Ukraine. And I think they'll take everything up to the Dnieper River in the northern half of Ukraine. And then down south, they'll cross the Dnieper. They have to if they're going to take all of Kherson, which they've annexed. And I wouldn't be surprised if they went into Odessa and one or two other oblasts as well. I think taking Odessa would make eminently good sense from their point of view. And again, let's just reemphasize that this is why you and I have long argued that the Ukrainians should cut a deal now and accommodate the Russians as much as possible so that they don't lose that territory. Don't give the Russians an incentive to take Odessa. But in fact, what's going on here, as you and I have said ad nauseum, is is that our policy, the Europeans' policy especially, and Ukraine's policy is incentivizing the Russians to take more territory. So I wouldn't be surprised if they take about 40%. And by the way, Danny, this is another whole subject. When they take more territory, even the territory that they've now annexed, there are going to be a lot of people left in those territories who are sympathetic to Ukraine and are hostile to Russia. And of course, the Ukrainians and the Europeans will go to great lengths to sabotage right. Russian efforts inside of the areas that they annex. And this will lead to significant ethnic cleansing. The Russians will have a very powerful incentive to drive ethnic Ukrainians or anybody who appears to be sympathetic to Ukraine or to the West out of the annexed territories. And at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if there's significant ethnic cleansing in the other direction. All of this just points out what a total disaster this whole situation is.
It does. Listen, before I let you go here, I want to shift gears to one other thing. You mentioned a second ago that whereas Putin has the sole focus on the Russia-Ukraine issue and their Western security, Western flank security, the United States has the Middle East, the Russia-Ukraine stuff, and also Asia. Well, it turns out that we're trying to add a fourth one to that. As Secretary of Defense or Secretary of War Hegseth last night announced Operation Southern Spear in America's southern neighborhood. And what's unclear, because he posted this X post last night, and with no explanation at all. We don't know if this is, there's another one, Operation Southern Spear, which has been existed for quite some time, which was directed towards really other things done there. We don't know if he's tagging onto that, if this is something new that's using the same language, but with the USS Ford sitting down in the waters just offside of Venezuela, as well as lots of other military capabilities down there. WTF, man, what are we doing down there?
Before I get to Venezuela, let me just say that you don't want to forget that President Trump was threatening Nigeria, the largest population in Africa is in Nigeria, and it's a huge piece of real estate. And because some radical Muslims were killing Christians, which is absolutely an absolutely horrible thing. And by the way, they were also killing
Muslims,
moderate Muslims, right? He was threatening to use military force there as well.
Guns a-blazing, he said. Yeah,
that's right. So, so we don't want to lose sight of that possible conflict as well. Going back to Venezuela, it appears to me that they're getting cold feet. They definitely have a lot of military force in the region now, especially that the Ford aircraft carrier is there. It's quite amazing how much military punch we've moved into the Caribbean. But the question is, what are we going to do with it? Are we going to invade Venezuela? Are we going to try to use that military to effect regime change? I really don't see how that's possible. I find it hard to believe that we would invade Venezuela. That would seem to me to be remarkably foolish and a mission that even the Trump administration would stay far away from. They may try regime change. I'm not sure you need all that military force for that purpose, but maybe they have some plan in mind for achieving this. Do you see any way they can use this military force to achieve some plausible political end? Am I missing something here that you see?
A political end, no. I can see us buying lots of trouble, and I can see, okay, there could be military tasks that could be accomplished like that. You could get a snatch and grab. You could use some of those marine amphibious units. If you identified where he was, you could go in and you could physically go in and make a quick snatch and grab if you had the opportunity to do so. But see, one of the problems I have with this, even taking the morality out of it or the legality for the moment and just looking at the capability, is that there are apparently people, Lindsey Graham being yet another one of these, but he's not the only one, that thinks this would be, and he said this, I'm not making this up, a layup. He said it wouldn't be hard. And he keeps going back to Operation Just Cause and when Reagan went in there to, and they got Noriega out and what's the other guy, I can't remember, but like those were quick. Those were easy. They were done. Yeah, people yelled about it a little bit, but they were short, snap, and they were done. Well, one of the things that was characterized at those times is that we didn't have this long period of build up. And number one, the forces on either of those cases had hardly any capability. But Venezuela is not those countries there. Those were small places, Panama, et cetera. These are much bigger, and they have now plenty of time to get ready. So I'm sure that they have, you know, they've mobilized people. They've mobilized some reservists. They've recruited more people. Their armed forces are on full alert. They've been flying their jets around, et cetera. So if we had any hope of doing a snatch and grab, it's gone, because now then they're fully prepared and awake. So now then any attempt to do that would be a massive, much more bloody and much less likely to succeed. So I'm kind of like you. I'm like, okay, you got, I think it's 10,000 troops in this area, along with all the naval firepower. You can blow up all kinds of stuff, no question about that, from the Ford. But what are you going to do with such a small number of people? And if you can't get in and out quick, this could turn into a bloodbath. And what, dare I say it, another Vietnam? I mean, I don't see anything. Maybe you do.
2 points, Danny. One is just to build on what you were saying. It reminds me more of Cuba. 1961 Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs, yeah. Yeah, that's what I was making. That's really bad, but I see a much better chance of a Bay of Pigs than I do in Operation Just Cause.
You want to remember, we were more dedicated to getting rid of Castro than we are to getting rid of Maduro or Chavez before that, right? And we couldn't do it. And we couldn't do it because we did not want to invade Cuba. It's a huge piece of real estate. And even though the American army outmatched the Cuban army, it would have been a fierce fight. And we didn't want to fight our way across the island and then dispose of Castro. So we actually used Cuban refugees, and it was an abysmal failure. But anyway, I take your point that this is not Grenada or Panama. This is more like Cuba. So this is going to be a tough operation. But let's assume that they do have some way of getting in there and snatching Maduro and then getting out, and there are minimal casualties. The question you have to ask yourself is, okay, what then? What happens then? They want regime change, right? That's their goal here. But you just can't go in and snatch the guy and put this woman in charge who is their favorite future leader and think you're going to live happily ever after. I don't think that's going to happen. Social engineering is a very difficult thing to do in your own country, right? If they made you or me president of the United States and we decided we were going to change a lot of things, I think we would find it extremely difficult to do. That's social engineering here in the United States, a country that both you and I know very well. You go into a country like Venezuela, this goes back to Vietnam, Afghanistan, you name it, and you think you can do social engineering easily? I don't think so. And just going in and snatching Maduro, that may be a necessary step, but it's not sufficient. So you'd be a lot smarter just leaving Maduro out, leaving Maduro in power, and working out some sort of modus vivendi. He's made it manifestly clear that he wants to work out a modus vivendi.
He did. Multiple times.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that the smart thing to do? I don't understand what I'm missing here. You know, sometimes when I look at what our government does, whether it's under Democrats or Republicans, it just seems to fail the common sense test. So the guy's a lefty. Who cares? Is he going to overthrow the government of the United States? The idea that he's funding narco terrorists? I mean, is this a serious argument?
Now, in the last few minutes that we have here, I wanted to ask you specifically on that. So Gary showed you that, Gary, if you still have it up, bring up that ex post by Secretary Hegseth, if you could, real briefly, because I want to look at what the language he actually said was. He was claiming that this is about narco terrorists. This is not about regime change. No, this is about, we want to keep the boat straight. What did he say? Joint Task Force Southern Spear. This mission defends our homeland, removes narco terrorists from our hemisphere, and secures the homeland from the drugs that are killing our people. Okay, it's self-evidently a mockery of any kind of use of the English language. When you send the Gerald R. Ford down there to defend speedboats, obviously that's not what they're there for, et cetera. Now, you have published some number of years ago this book, Why Leaders Lie. And I think when you wrote this book, you're saying, like, and I may be paraphrasing here, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that only works, leaders lie, if they tell the truth most of the time because they can get certain things done here. But now then, the leaders are saying things that are just blatantly, self-evidently untrue, so no one believes anything that they're saying. Where is this leading us?
Well, nobody can get away with a lie. I mean, Donald Trump can't get away with a lie because people tend to think that everything he says is basically a lie, or a lot of what he says is a lie. So people have their guard up, and lying is really no longer a very effective instrument of statecraft. As you said, lying is deadly effective when you expect the other side to tell the truth. If the other side has a rich history of telling the truth, you think you're dealing with a straight shooter, you're in a situation where you're a perfect target for a sophisticated lie, but we're not living in that world. The problem when you have lots of lying taking place and people don't believe anything that is said, the culture becomes corrupted. And that's really what's happened in the United States. The reason that lying is shunned upon in general is because it has a corrupting influence on any culture. And I think the constant lying that takes place, the spinning, the deception that you see in the United States and in the West more generally these days does not work to our advantage. It's probably not very popular to say this, but when Putin speaks, I have greater trust that he is telling the truth than when I hear any Western leader speak. This is not to say that Putin never lies or Xi Jinping never lies, but they tend to be straight shooters. I think that what they say in most cases is truthful. With regard to the United States, I don't feel the same.
And what is the implications of that domestically? Forget about international. I think it's pretty self-evident that no one believes anything we say at face value. They almost assume it's not true, and then they'll look to find out what the actions are on the ground, and then they'll figure it out from there, and then they have to interpret. That's his problem in his own. But what about domestically? What happens when the leaders lie so normally that we literally, I doubt very seriously anyone of any serious person believes what Secretary Hegseth wrote there. So then we're left to just figure out what they really mean here. And everybody gets, maybe their interpretations could be different. What is the consequence domestically when the routine lie becomes normal?
Well, again, just as foreign leaders don't believe what our leaders are saying on the foreign policy front, most people don't believe that either. You see this in the Jeffrey Epstein case, right? Lots of people believe that President Trump is lying when he says there's really nothing there. And of course, it's not only President Trump, but it's other people in his administration who are saying there's nothing there, there's no need to release these files. And huge numbers of people simply don't believe that. Trump can't convince them. You can see how frustrated Trump is in his inability to shut down the Epstein case. And the reason he can't shut it down is nobody believes him. When Trump says that there's nothing there, people think exactly the opposite. Of course there's something there. By the way, what's happened in this country is that a huge chunk of the public, or huge chunks of the public, do not believe what the elites say on almost any issue. This is really what is behind, in good part, the MAGA phenomenon. The MAGA phenomenon is all about distrust of the elites. You can't trust these people. They don't tell the truth. And they manipulate the system for their own benefit and at our expense. And I would just say to you, that once people in a society begin to think that way, once they begin to think that they can't trust their leaders, that their leaders are dishonest, and they're being dishonest in a way, right, that disadvantages people down below, your society is going to end up in really serious trouble. You're going to have maybe even a revolution of sorts, because people are going to be so dissatisfied. Or if you don't have a revolution, you'll have violence. But moreover, the system is just not going to work smoothly, because the transaction costs of doing business in a society where you can't trust anybody are just enormous.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we're seeing it play out right in front. I mean, you just, that was the Epstein issue is just the latest big example. And there's others. And when you don't have trust in anything, I mean, MAGA right now is following Donald Trump. But I think that he makes a mistake if he believes that that can never turn against him, because he mobilized it. But I think that if it goes far enough, that for the enough lies, he could actually find himself at the victim of it, not the supporter of it. But we'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But in any case, as always, we're very grateful for you coming on today and providing such clarity on this. And anybody wants to know more about this, Why Leaders Lie, the book that I have here on my desk, you can go to Amazon. You can pull it right down off of there and you can read it yourself. Recommend that you do. Grateful for you coming on today. And as always, we appreciate your viewpoints.
Thank you, Danny. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Although I must say, it's very depressing to have to deal with these issues week after week and see that, you know, our policymakers don't seem to learn and continue to pursue foolish policies that not only work to our disadvantage, but work to the disadvantage of lots of other people around the world. When you talk about American leadership today, it's hard not to think that American leadership has lost its way, that our policies are bankrupt. And this is not restricted to the Trump administration. It's certainly right. True of the Biden administration as well. I mean, we didn't even talk about the genocide in Gaza, but just hard.
Yeah, we could do another whole show just on that, too. That's just across the board. We're unintimidated and uncompromised to bring the truth, no matter what it is. And stuff like this is stuff that people need to hear, because you can't, until you find out what's going on, you understand the scope, then you have the possibility of maybe improving things. And that's our hope, that by telling the truth that you tell on here, and the reality, that people can finally start going, yeah, maybe there is a better way. That's the hope.
Let's hope you're right.
That's all we got right now. So we're going to cling to that. And we appreciate you guys. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't done that on your way out. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about this issue, the Department of War fraud, and how it's not going to end well, today at 2:15 p.m. So I'm going to go back and talk a little bit more detail about that, and we'll have some new information for you then. Thanks very much, folks, and we'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.